Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Warman Olney back with Which Way L.A. The U.S. Forest Service knew it was bad, but not how bad. After 4 years of drought, it figured that 12.5 million trees had died in southern and central California. Then Greg Asner spent many days flying over the territory with high-tech equipment that measures the amount of water in tree leaves below. He's with the Carnegie Institution for Science. Greg Asner, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So the Forest Service had an estimate. I don't know that you're able to provide a count of trees, but how much worse than the Forest Service estimate do you think the situation really is?
Well, our estimates are based on a different approach. So it's a bit like comparing an apple and an orange. Their estimates are based on flying low over a portion of the state's forests and really literally counting dead trees. Our approach is flying over all of the state's forest, and rather than going for which trees are dead, we're actually trying to assess which trees are most vulnerable to death, which is a slightly different technique, but no matter how we've cut it, it's going to be a pretty high number this year. We're still working on the details of how many trees it equates to and what the prognosis is, but it's going to be a large number.
Tell us a little bit more, if you will, about how you reach these estimates at all. How are you able to determine how much water there is in the leaves of trees?
We have a technology, it's got a fancy name called imaging spectroscopy. And what that's about is a system that can actually measure the mass of water in the tree canopy, in the foliage of the tree itself. And that measurement, it turns out, is very sensitive to drought stress. So if a tree is doing well and is getting lots of water, then it'll have a very high number in terms of the water content in the tree. And as it gets stressed under conditions of drought, it'll lose that water, and our systems are able to see that change.
So how bad is the situation then in Southern California particularly, and how much of the forest do you think is vulnerable and perhaps even dead already?
Well, we're close to having answers on that. What we've seen, probably the best way for me to explain is to give you a quick tour around the state as to what we've seen from the air. And I think that'll give a general impression of kind of the scale of what we're dealing with. It does start in the southern forests, north of L.A., Los Angeles area. Those forests are in really bad shape, extremely drought-stricken, lots of leaflessness, a lot of dead trees. As you go up into the Sierras, moving north and inland, we're seeing large expanses of very stressed tree canopy. Some of it is dead. Some of it is still eking by, but it's in trouble. As you go further north in the Sierras, you see patches of extremely drought-stricken forest all the way up, all the way to the Oregon border. Even in the northwest forests that have traditionally, in the coastal range, that have traditionally been thought of as reasonably humid and able to get past some of this drought issue, we've mapped out a large, patchy mosaic of just extreme drought stress among certain forests up there. So you really can't get away from it anywhere in the state now, but it's not an even distribution. It's real patchy out there, and it sums up to a large number. We're just working on that number now.
Are we looking then at real changes in the pattern of vegetation in California?
Could be. You know, California has had droughts over, you know, very, very long time scales, and the science doesn't know how species will shift or respond over the long term. But our best scientific estimates are that, yeah, we're going to lose a lot of trees, and other species may move in to those new openings that are, you know, generated by the loss of some trees and some species. We don't really know. It's one of these situations where we're just now getting the technology to monitor and measure the changes as they're taking place. But it's going to take us doing repeat measurements and really working on this over a longer period to assess whether there's going to be long-term shifts in what we see in terms of, you know, the composition of our forests in California.
You have said that the mountains ringing Los Angeles are a tinderbox.
Yeah, there's some of the driest forests we've seen. Extreme levels of drought stress. Not much water in those canopies. Not a happy place to be a tree these days. Those have, you know, in the past undergone drought, and, you know, we almost expect it in some of those systems nowadays, given the lack of rainfall we've had for so many years. It's really in the Sierras that we've seen some of the most dramatic changes, and those are places where I think we need to add attention, scientific attention, and conservation and management attention.
Greg Asner is an earth scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science. One of those who was taken aback by his findings was Ashley Conrad Seda. She is Deputy Secretary for Climate Policy at the California Environmental Protection Agency. Thanks a lot for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
How much worse is it than you thought it was?
Well, an order of magnitude after that 12.5 million tree number. Talking with Greg and seeing some of his data, we realized that it could potentially be an order of magnitude worse.
So that's a lot.
That is a lot. 10 times worse. Yes, that is a lot, and it it makes us think very hard about where we should be allocating our management dollars, and if we should be changing the way we've been doing the management work that we've been able to do in the forests.
What, in addition to the forest, needs to be managed?
Well, you know, the forests are the source of the water for Californians, especially in urbanized areas, and if we can't address what's going on in the forests, we actually risk a lot of water quality and supply issues for downstream water users. And there's also other services that forests provide, like erosion control, jobs, tourism, recreation, places for people to live, places for animals to live. So it's really important for us to not only restore the forests, but actively manage them to make sure that they're with us for many, many more years.
How certain are you that the forests can be restored?
Like Greg said, I think we're learning a lot through all of these assessments, and I think over time in working with scientists like Greg and others, we'll be able to understand that uncertainty more.
So this is new information that you're getting, and you're having to, I take it, to revise plans that have been made in the past. What are we going to see in the way of change?
Well, currently the state is working on a number of different processes to address issues within the forest sector. So we have a forest climate action team that's working on a forest carbon plan, because obviously forests are also very important for our long-term climate goals as they sequester carbon. So in that plan, we'll be taking a look at the range of data coming not only from Greg's research, but also from the state's Air Resources Board and the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. We'll also be using this as we set our longer-term target goals in the scoping plan for AB 32.
The forests sequester carbon under good circumstances. If they burn, though,
right,
they contribute to global warming. What about that?
That's right. And we've actually gotten a lot of research in from a number of different universities and research groups telling us more about what we can expect to see in the forests over time. As Greg noted, there is variation and expected variability in forests. So we're trying not to be overly alarmed, but to take it in stride and sort of take the long view on our management plans. So again, we will continue to work to use the best available science to make sure that our management decisions are not made in haste, but are really thinking about how we ensure California's future.
Greg Asner, back to you again, earth scientist with the Carnegie Institution for Science. This flyover of the state this summer, as I take it, was something that you were able to do because you had $250,000. In a grant from the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. Do you have the money to continue this research?
Well, that's a great question. Scientists like me tend to work project to project. In the state of California context, we're committed to providing the best science for the scientific community, but also for the management and conservation and decision-making communities, just like Ashley's talking about. So my goal is to try to find the support from different parts, different stakeholders, to continue to be able to fly at least every year to update our assessments and to provide this kind of scientific core support to many of the agencies that Ashley talked about.
So, Ashley Conrad Seda, back to you with the EPA. Is it possible for the state to finance these kinds of studies, or do you have to wait for private entities to come through?
Well, monitoring is an important part of any of our expenditures. You know, we want to make sure that the public trust is being spent in a way that we follow the use of those dollars. So potentially, the type of work that Greg's talking about could be funded by monitoring dollars associated with any of the grant or incentive programs the state funds. At this point, we're still working within our agencies to figure out, you know, our options for funding this type of work. And really, because it's so new to us, we're just working closely with Greg to understand the work that he's doing.
In the meantime, you talked about all the possible impacts that this might have, not just on the water quality, but on tourism and jobs, animals moving around in the forest, and so on. What do you think we're going to see first in terms of the consequences of this development?
Well, something that we're working on and we're concerned about right now is just the getting a handle on where we're seeing the greatest amount of threats around the state, and that's where Greg's data can help us. Where should we be focusing? Where is the greatest risk for people in the state and for the resources that we care about in the state? So that's step one, is actually getting sort of a threat or risk assessment, and after that, then we will work with all of our agencies and with all of our stakeholders and the public to understand what steps would be best for us to take next.
And Greg Asner, will El Nino make a difference?
Well, that's a tough one to answer right now. El Nino after severe drought doesn't alleviate drought. What we need is rain or precipitation in the Sierras that'll provide snowpack that'll literally feed ecosystems and the water supply of people of the state of California. El Nino typically brings a lot of rain to Southern Cal. We'll see if it reaches up and gets the Sierras, outfitted with snowpack this year. But either way, the drought is so prolonged and so deep that our climate scientists tell me that it's going to take a lot more than an El Nino to fully recover.
All right. Greg Asner, once again, Carnegie Institution for Science, trying to measure the problem. Ashley Conrad Seda with the California Environmental Protection Agency, trying to figure out what to do about it. Thank you both for being on our program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, L.A. County's new sheriff wants to change the culture of his department on Which Way L.A.
Visit the Which Way L.A. blog for an extension of what Los Angeles is made of. News, arts, culture, and the fabric of Southern California, all in one place and updated daily. Check it out now at kcrw.com/whichwayla.
Warren Alnebeck with Which Way LA. Jim McDonnell served with the LAPD and as chief of police in Long Beach. When he was elected sheriff of Los Angeles County last November, he was new to a department that had suffered through 4 years of reports of brutality and other forms of misconduct. Now he says it's time to change the culture. Sheriff, welcome as always.
Thank you, Warren. Thanks for having me.
What about those veterans who look at you? You're still the new guy, even though you are in charge, and hear that you want to change the culture. Are you worried that they might be resentful?
You know, it's not so much coming in to change the culture. There's an aspect of it, and we saw individuals who were out of line and in some cases engaged in criminal activity. The culture of this organization and the tradition is a very positive one. Most of the people who work here work very hard every day, doing a very complex job exceptionally well. What we're looking to do is, as we continue to hire now, and we're hiring quicker than we have been able to in the past, my goal is to be able to do so in a way where we add to the great foundation we have. We don't jeopardize quality for the purpose of hiring quickly. And that's been done in this organization and other organizations across America, that when you hire in boom and bust cycles, you end up overwhelming the system, the background capabilities, and the screening process, and end up bringing in people in many cases that would not ordinarily make it. So the goal is to be able to build on the great tradition we have and to be able to ensure that the people we bring on, we're as proud of them as we are of most of our people.
Can you get rid of the people that you feel are not appropriate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the process takes care of itself. We're holding people accountable to a very high standard. As we move forward, each person will be responsible for their actions, and you know, people throughout the organization know that the tone is very clear, that we're serious about the business. We treat the tradition of the organization with a great deal of respect, and we want everybody who wears that badge to wear it with pride and to treat it the way that it should be appropriately treated. Those who came before us and those who will follow us are dependent on us representing it as well as we can while we wear it.
Have you actually been able to fire bad apples? And if so, how many?
Yeah, I can't give you numbers, but certainly we've held a lot of people accountable in the almost year now that I've been on board, and I know that was being done prior to my coming on board under my predecessor and John Scott. And you know, it's a business where people are given very little information, inserted into very volatile situations, and oftentimes things don't go the way you would like to if you had more time. But our goal is to train people to work as well as they can under those difficult circumstances, to give them the tools they need to do things well, and to be able to support them where they're right, hold them accountable where they're not, and you know, re-engage the public's trust, and as best we can, improve morale within the organization so we work at an optimal level.
You're dealing with an enormous institution, the fourth largest local police agency in the country.
Exactly.
18,000.
Second,
okay.
Yeah.
It used to be the fourth. I guess it's risen. 18,000 employees, 9,100 of them sworn employees. What do you do about the people who say, wait a minute, you know, we want to make change. We have always done things in a certain way. We're always going to do them in a certain way. Aren't they the ones who often become the real teachers for the new people who come in?
You know, I think we've got a population within the department who sees the need for change. We've had a crisis. We're going to take advantage of that crisis to be able to be a best practice organization so that others around the country, as they continue to come here, to be able to say, can you help us with these difficulties we're having? And it, across the board, this is a complex organization that deals not only in general policing in an urban environment, but also the largest jail system, the largest court system, community college system, the public transportation system, a search and rescue effort, so many different types of policing that we do that you don't see in many other places in one organization. So we're blessed to have the responsibilities and the support of the public that we have in L.A. County to be able to do the job that we do.
How long do you think it'll take to really make a change?
Well, I think we've made a change from day one. I think coming in, setting the tone very, very clearly as to what the expectations are, and then having the systems of accountability be consistent with what we're saying. I think we've seen that, you know, throughout the time I've been here, which is all I can speak to, and I think we've seen a change. I think, you know, attitudes and support of our personnel who are doing a good job and trying to be able to obtain for our folks the tools necessary to do the job as well as and safely as it can be done.
So, again, you have 18,000 employees, 9,100 of them suborn officers. How many people are you going to be hiring that are going to be new in how short a time?
Well, we're starting off with this coming budget year. We have budget approval to be able to hire 8 classes of 85 to 90 deputy sheriff trainees in each one. So we'd be graduating a class every 6 to 7 weeks. That's way ahead of what we've been able to do in the recent past. So hopefully we'll be able to see, you know, some benefit from that. Currently, one of the major issues we have is we're basically forcing our employees to work overtime, which is having an impact on morale and beyond. And so to be able to bring enough people on board to be able to provide sufficient backup and be able to staff the way we appropriately should be staffing will be a big relief moving forward.
What standards are you using for new recruits, and what new methods are you using to try to get the kind of people you want to see?
Well, really looking for the people that you would want to be able to see when you call 911 or someone in your family reaches out for police help, the type of person that you would want to show up. You'd want somebody who's competent, who has good character, and who is compassionate. Somebody who's going to be able to take care of business, but do so in a way that is done with dignity and respect.
How many applications do you get, and how many of them actually make it into the academy?
Well, we're getting about between 500 and 700 applications a week right now, and it takes, say, 100 applicants to be able to get 4 who make it to the academy. 3 of those 4 will make it through the academy.
How many people do you have to go over all those applications and decide who's going to get in and who's not?
Well, that's a big infrastructure cost in itself, just the ability to be able to screen and triage and be able then to test and to do the background investigations and all of the logistical support to make this necessary or to make it effective is a giant job in itself. So we've put a lot of additional resources in that. We've gotten $50 million from the Board of Supervisors to be able to do that, and we've added an additional $21 million from existing department resources. But it's a work in progress, and it is a giant effort. So I would encourage anybody who is interested in a great career with a great future, certainly where it now is a good time to apply.
Doing a little recruiting on our program.
Absolutely.
So how many people do you actually have, though, to process all those applications? It must be an enormous department.
You know, we have our personnel folks, and we have backgrounds, and we hire back some of our retirees to come in and help with the backgrounds, and they work part-time doing that, but that's their sole focus. So we have people who are experienced investigators who are focused just on the background process.
Are you having to staff the jails with more people than has been the case in the past?
We have, yeah, absolutely. It was not sufficiently staffed in the past, and the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence brought that out, and now we're working on a federal consent decree, and also bears out the need to be able to staff it sufficiently so our deputy sheriffs, our custody assistants, and our staff within the jail environment are safe and able to provide backup for each other and to be able to do the job in a way that is a best practice nationwide.
A lot of the unfortunate incidents that have been reported over the past few years have to do with jailhouse brutality. Now, that's the first assignment for every deputy that comes out of the academy. And there are those who say that people who work in the jails then take that culture of brutality with them when they go out on patrol. You've indicated you don't want to change that. You don't want to have different people handling custody than are handling patrol. Why not?
Well, what I'm looking to do is have a dual-track system where we hire people who want to work in the custody environment, we send them to an academy, and we train them up to be specialists in that environment. We then give them a career path when they can promote up through the ranks but remain specialists in custody. Likewise, those who want to work in the patrol side of the house, to be able to come in, go to the academy, be trained in community policing efforts, and then to go immediately out into the field. We're not at a place where we can do that yet. Currently, everybody does, all deputy sheriffs do some time in the jail, but it was up to 7 years before you were able to get to the street in the recent past, and we've knocked that down quite a ways. So we're on the road to be able to have a dual-track system that actually works for us.
It was 7 years. How many years now?
You know, it depends on where the person wants to go when they leave the jail environment. There's a different level of a waiting list for each of the stations.
Okay, an enormous job, and obviously you have your work cut out for you, as you knew when you got elected to be sheriff of Los Angeles County.
No, thank you, Warren.
All right, Jim McDonald, once again, the sheriff of the county. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Warren.